Hey, folks, thanks for tuning in to another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Before we get to the fun, here's a quick word from one of our sponsors.
We've got a Keto Masterclass testimonial from Allison. Allison says, Rob Wolf, I am so glad I spent the $49 and finally learned to do keto correctly. I'm trying not to geek out on numbers, but I've lost 5.5 inches on my waist, 18 pounds, and it's day 35. I'm telling everyone I know, Keto Masterclass. So if you want to go keto, but you're not quite sure where to start, or maybe you're eating keto already, but not sure you're doing it right, go to ketomasterclass.com/go.
Hey folks, six listeners can't be wrong. Another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Really had a fun time today. I got to talk to Dr. Emery Liscord. She is the Assistant Medical Director at the Department of Emergency Medicine, Maine General Medical Center. She has a really fascinating story, battling with some health issues from a diet that was not matched to her physiology, despite being a medical student and a marathon runner. And then she's just right in the front line of where our current healthcare situation is. I believe she quoted about 90% of the things that she sees as an emergency room physician. They're preventable, you know, but that prevention involves a massive number of issues, ranging from our food system to kind of social processes. And we dug into a lot of this stuff. I don't know that we got to a concrete answer on anything other than holy smokes, you know, this is a complex topic. But really had a great time talking with Dr. Liscord. I think that you will enjoy it too. Hey, Doc, are you there?
I am here, Rob.
Cool. Dr. Liscord is with me. We had minor technical issues, which have resulted in a hardwire Ethernet connection and sitting Indian style in your basement, it sounds like.
Exactly. It's fantastic.
Awesome.
Love it.
Doc, hey, thank you for coming on the show. Thanks for navigating the little technical difficulties that we had getting going. You shot me an email recently.
Yes,
and
I did.
Kind of made an introduction. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself? I covered some of this in the introduction, but it'd be great to get a little bit more of your background.
Absolutely. So I'm an emergency medicine physician. I graduated from Dartmouth Medical School and did my emergency medicine training at Boston Medical Center. I was sort of looking for kind of the craziest, busiest ER in all of New England, and that's where I landed. And the reason that I, you know, reached out to you, Rob, is because, you know, I left Boston and I moved to kind of a rural area in Maine and just kind of started to pay attention to what I was seeing in the emergency department, which really was quite different from what I expected to be treating when I went into that specialty. And I'll tell you, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, you go ahead. You go ahead.
Yeah, no. So it's kind of wild. I would say probably 80 to 90% of what I see in the emergency department is 100% preventable by lifestyle modifications. And I just, through my own health journey, and I'm happy to talk about this or not, but I, you know, I was started running marathons in medical school. And as a lean marathon runner, I was diagnosed with prediabetes. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. And I, somebody who was not in medicine gave me the primal blueprint. So that was sort of my first introduction to this world. And I just have gone down the rabbit hole ever since. And just really frustrated with my own profession, the healthcare system, and the lack of resources that I'm seeing in that my patients have here in Central Maine. So my husband and I started kind of a health advocacy group, and we teach classes in the community, and I'm trying to teach other physicians about a healthier way of living. So that's kind of my background.
That's amazing. You know, we get a lot of questions around kind of career path. And before, I definitely want to hear more about your own health journey, but why did you choose emergency medicine? Like a lot of folks, they'll fire an email and they're like, hey, I want to make a difference. Should I do this? Should I do that? And without knowing the person, like, How are you wired up, and why did emergency medicine appeal to you?
Right. So, I mean, I think I would say I'm a bit of an adrenaline junkie. So
Shocker.
We'll just put that out there. But the other thing was, in medicine, you make kind of a decision. And it's, do you like taking care of people who are mostly well, or do you like taking care of people who are ill? And if that makes sense, like critically ill, acutely ill. And I found that I thought I'd be a family doc. I went into medicine with family docs in my family, and I kind of assumed that's what I would do. But I found that it was just, I felt like the visits were short. People weren't making a change. They weren't getting better. And an ER for me was very tangible. Somebody comes in, they have a dislocated shoulder. Boom, I can put that back in. Someone's in a car accident, I can stabilize them. Somebody has a heart attack. The thing is that, and this comes out of the military really, is that medicine is fantastic if you want to live to tomorrow. And we really got it down. I mean, emergency medicine is really good. But the chronic stuff, as you know, Rob, is just, we are failing and flailing and people are getting sicker. And so I liked that, being able to tangibly make a difference in that moment. But what I'm realizing is, you know, I make right now with my practice every day, it's like, you know, I see people and yeah, I can stabilize them when they have their heart attack or their stroke, but they're back in a couple weeks later with something related. And it's just, the more medicines people are on, the sicker they're getting. And it's just, it's so kind of frustrating.
No, it is. I remember doing my undergrad, I worked as a pharmacy tech, and folks would come in and they'd be older, you know, maybe like mid-60s, late-60s, and oftentimes they would comment, well, this is my first prescription, you know, almost like a badge of honor kind of thing. And they typically were reasonably lean, reasonably healthy. Like, there was just this interesting demographic of like older folks coming in, first prescription, and then son of a gun, if it wasn't like, oh, now it's 2, 3, 4, and it seemed like the wheels fell off. And I would, you know, on lunch breaks, I'd talk to the pharmacist, I'm like, hey, do you notice this trend? And they're like, yeah, you know, and it's just one of those things where we would talk about it a little bit, but we didn't really know what to do. And this was, you know, 5, 6 years or maybe even longer than that before any of this ancestral health stuff got on my radar. But even at that point, like,
people were starting to realize, I mean, it's just like, you think about, we went from, okay, let's put statins in the water, to oops, it causes diabetes in 40% of women. Oops. So, you know, it's basically, we have a philosophy like with our work, which is less is more. The less you put, you do not need a pill, a supplement, a shake. You don't need anything. You actually need to take a lot of stuff away, you know, in terms, if you want to see better health. And that includes prescribed medications. And I'm actually doing a fellowship in obesity medicine, which I really like, that the Obesity Medicine Association. So this is, you know, Western medicine, but they have really, you know, they have Stephen Finney, Jeff Volek, you know, Jason Fung are all lecturing at these obesity medicine, you know, conferences. So they're really kind of on the cutting edge of nutrition. And I've said to my husband, you know, in the emergency room, I don't think I've ever in the, oh, how long have I been doing this? 8, 10 years? I don't you know, I never have seen an obese person over the age of 80, because you just don't live that long when you have so much weight.
Right. No, it totally makes sense. Hey, let's dig in a little bit more about your health situation, because again, if we went to maybe the more, you know, kind of mainstream dietetics kind of scene, you know, the Alan Aragons of the world, it's basically like eat more or less whatever you want, you know, just watch the amounts. And if you exercise, all is right in the world.
Right. Exactly.
You're super well educated. Dartmouth is arguably one of the best medical schools in the world. So clearly you are smart and talented. And you had the gumption to do both medical school and embark on marathon training. Now, I could probably make an argument that lurking in the background of all that, there was some sleep deprivation and like some, you know, hypervigilant state that was probably contributing to this. But how did you, as a young, smart medical student, develop pre-diabetes through the process of embarking on marathon training.
I know, isn't it wild? Well, I mean, I'm not really sure, but I'll tell you that nobody in my family has diabetes. Like, everybody's pretty lean. So it doesn't run in my family, because I'm sure genetics, I believe that genetics does play a role, mm-hmm. not completely. I had started getting into running as kind of, I would say, productive procrastination. It was the one time I didn't feel guilty for not studying was when I was out for a run.
Right.
And, but I fueled with, gels, crackers. I mean, I was the, you know, like low fat, high carb popcorn. I would eat 2 bags of popcorn for a meal. I mean, this was sort of what we did, you know, this was endurance training.
Right.
And then when I was in residency, I actually got pregnant in residency, and that's not stressful. Then I was diagnosed, my hemoglobin A1C was a lot higher than I would expect. And that's when I, you know, started looking at ancestral health. And I actually, once I cut my carbohydrates down a little bit, it wasn't even ketogenic. You know, we're talking down to 100, 150. I normalized my hemoglobin A1C, and I started to just feel a whole lot better. And this is what really clicked for me. And ever since then, I haven't looked back. That was my son's 6 now. So that was 6 years ago. And since then, I've sort of, you know, I'm still running. So I actually used to work the medical tent at the marathon in Boston. And I took care of some of the bombing victims and during the Boston Marathon bombing. And so I always made this goal that I wanted to run the Boston Marathon, but I didn't really want to raise money. So I wanted to qualify. And, you know, but I didn't want to get diabetes. So how do you train for a marathon and not get diabetes eating all this high carb stuff? So that's when I got really into the more fat adapted running, the ketogenic athlete type, you know, working towards low carb running. And it was great. I qualified for Boston. I ran Boston and fueled on fat, and it was great.
That's awesome. And you know, yeah. I love that you mentioned that, you know, you didn't have to go into like the extreme ketogenic world. It's so funny. Keto is amazing. It's such an underutilized tool.
Yep.
But the world has become this thing where it's either keto or you're eating like Katavan level of carbs, and there's no middle ground there.
People are too dogmatic, and you get into trouble. And one thing, I'm super interested in epigenetics and genetics. And one thing I've realized is probably related to our genetics, but you know, people have different genetic polymorphisms that maybe they don't metabolize saturated fat very well. Maybe they do better on a high carb, or at least I would say never eating processed food. I think that's one thing we can all agree on. But I think being dogmatic, you come into a lot of problems with that. And I think keto is extraordinarily powerful for people who have metabolic disease. But I also think that eating a sweet potato when you're training for a marathon is okay. And you shouldn't have to like beat yourself up about that.
Well, and it's funny because, you know, you establish the crazy thing in this, you know, let's look back to what Atkins recommended ages ago. Let's really ratchet carbs down, get the metabolic syndrome reversed, and now let's titrate you up, focusing mainly on whole unprocessed foods to a point where are you able to maintain weight and general metabolic health? Are you generally feeling well? And if we tip over that, then let's just reel it back in. And that just seems like a very reasonable approach. And it's very customizable too. Like, we don't know exactly where you are on that spectrum. We don't know where you will finish when everything is said and done, again, because of genetic and epigenetic considerations. But within that, we can really dial this whole story up and down. But you propose that, and it's like madness.
Yeah. And I think also something that I've been super interested in just over the summer is the idea of being more seasonal. And I'm learning that, you know, you're more insulin sensitive in the summers. You know, everything's on a circadian rhythm. We've learned that from the work of Sachin Panda, who, you know, you probably have read about. And so like maybe in the summertime when you're picking blueberries, like you can eat some blueberries. It's okay, you know? And like, but in the winter months, you know, when we didn't have access to a lot of starchy vegetables and whatnot, maybe we are eating more fat and meat. And I think that's also, once you're metabolically flexible, that is definitely a nice way to be able to enjoy the seasons and not be so dogmatic. But I do think that, and I know you guys have the Keto Masterclass. I was just reading about it on your website, and I think that's awesome. Actually, we are doing grand rounds on the ketogenic diet in October this year.
Oh,
so,
nice.
Which is,
nice.
I don't know if you're familiar with what grand rounds is, but this is the whole hospital. All the physicians in the hospital are invited, and they do a lecture on a topic. So I'm really excited about it. I'm a little nervous about like what my cardiology colleagues are going to say. So right. I got to know the lipid stuff, like the back of my hand.
That's amazing. Do you know who is speaking at that event, or who is it's a multi-series event usually, right?
No. So Grand Rounds is every week, and okay. It's all hospitals hold Grand Rounds, and you know, it's just on different topics, and all specialties are invited. So one of my colleagues, Dr. Mador, is a functional medicine physician in the area, and we've kind of teamed up trying to make change in our community, and he invited me to help him with that. So we're really excited about that.
That's awesome. I will forward you a bunch of papers I received from Bill Cromwell, who's the developer of the LPIR score and all that NMR technology. And
awesome. That would be super helpful.
Yeah. He's an amazing guy. So, man, I want to ask this question, but I don't want it to be super leading. But
okay.
where are the problems in the current healthcare, sick care system?
Like, oh, yes. I love this subject.
Like, I mean, if you were to delineate like 5 points or 10 points or whatever, like where would we tackle this? And I mean, it could literally start anywhere from like food production or, you know, whatever you want to jump into.
Yeah. So first I would say defining what I've run into in my community. So my kids are, one is at daycare and one started kindergarten. And I will tell you that this has been a struggle for me. I have been trying to get them to serve food that is unprocessed in real food at the daycare and the school. And I just got the lunch list, and it's like mac and cheese for lunch and crackers for a snack. And what I think the problem is, because I've gone to some of the administrators in these organizations, and the problem is they get federal funding, so they have to follow the quote unquote USDA guidelines. Now, personally, I think that the USDA guidelines are pretty general. Like, you don't have to serve processed carbohydrates. Like, you could serve some sweet potato or something like that. But the problem is, I think, following the USDA guidelines, and that's at a federal level. And then the other problem is just the money, just the cost. Now, I think that I live in farmland, so I think there are creative ways to get around that, partnering with local farmers and whatnot. But it takes organization. And I think that, you know, organizations are just so resistant to change. And then, so that's like at a local kind of organizational level. These are problems we've run into. But from a physician, so this is the biggest challenge. I have a lot of colleagues who, because, you know, I kind of associate with people who are familiar with this stuff. You know, I have friends, a lot of physician friends who practice intermittent fasting, time-restricted feeding. A lot of them are intermittently ketogenic. You know, they're aware of this. But I've talked to them about their practice with their patients, and their fears lie in the fact that the American Diabetes Association, the American Heart Association have these guidelines, and they worry medically legally. So, you know, once you have an MD or a DO next to your name, like, you're open, you know, if you say something different from a guideline, someone could come back and, you know, hold you accountable, like, legally. So physicians, even though they might know this stuff, they feel like their hands are somewhat tied because they're supposed to follow these guidelines and their practices are monitored. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's almost, you know, it's weird because, you know, my husband's a personal trainer and does some health coaching with his, you know, clients, and
he almost has more latitude than
he has way more. In fact, to the point where, like, I'm like, nope, I can't even have a one-on-one meeting with someone, because then if somebody can say, you know, I'm their physician, they can say what I say is medical advice. Even if you have every disclaimer in the world, it doesn't protect you. And so I think where we really need to make change is sort of at the more institutional level. But unfortunately, as you probably know, within these governing bodies in medicine are conflicts of interest. And you can't really find them easily, but if you go on the American Heart Association, the American Dietetics Association, you know, when you start looking, you start to see that they get some of their funding from parts of the food industry or the pharmaceutical industry. And it's just really hard to compete with, you know, big business. I am, you know, I can't compete with the Koch brothers, you know, I can't. So that, I don't know how to do that. I think I'm feeling right now like I'm going to approach this from a local level. Like I'm really going to start getting involved with the school board, getting involved with local, because I feel like that seems more approachable to me. But I do believe we need help at the, you know, the federal level as well.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting and such a morass. And like, I've seemed like a crazy person because for ages I've been talking about the subsidies that are generating this kind of junk food catastrophe. And like, if you look back when Richard Nixon was getting reelected in 1971, I think he needed a conservative voting base to support him. And they had largely disbanded the farm subsidies programs that were enacted during World War II, but they were still on the books. They were still there. There was still a template. And so they just ramped that up and he got his voting base. And then there were a couple of years, I was born in 72, and I vaguely remember this period of time where the news pieces would talk about like these warehouses of food just rotting and spoiling. So then they had to figure out what to do with this stuff. And that's when high fructose corn syrup was developed and all this other stuff. And parallel to that was this fear of fat, fear of animal-based fat, and this emergence of these super cheap seed oils that could be hydrogenated. And, you know, and so it was just this kind of perfect storm. But you've got that subsidies part on the one hand. You have the collusion part, you know, it maybe at the upper end. And CrossFit is interesting in that they're the only entity that it kind of has a global reach that has been talking about the collusion between, you know, basically like Coke or, you know, what let's call it Big Sugar, and kind of the influence that they had on things like the Affordable Care Act. Like there was this provision of exercise as medicine. The basic line item was, hey, we need to get people to exercise more. We're going to government subsidize coaches and personal trainers to exercise these people, but you will not comment on the qualitative nature of their diet. And oh, by the way, they can have up to 6 servings of sugared sodas a day. And that's fine. I threw this on my Facebook page the other day and people lost their minds.
Oh, I know. I mean, I just, we have a Facebook page as well. And I was just posted an article about just the history of the vegetable oil industry and like where that comes from. And it's just, you read it and you're like, ew. I mean, and it's everywhere and it's so, it feels overwhelming, although I have to feel hopeful because at least in the field of Western medicine, like I said, like this fellowship, people ask me like, what are you going to do with this fellowship? I mean, you're an emergency medicine doctor. Are you going to do weight loss counseling in the ER? Probably not. But what I do want to do is I want to get kind of those, that accreditation so that I can now go talk to physicians where I am a clinical professor at the University of New England in Maine. And so I can speak to medical students and teach in the community and sort of, but I know it's just, it feels overwhelming.
It kind of is in a way, but I think that your point about starting at the grassroots level is really the only way this is going to happen. It's really fascinating to me. So our clinic here in Reno, we have worked with police, military, and fire. We did a 2-year pilot study that saved the Reno.
I heard about that. That's awesome.
You know, it saved the city of Reno $22 million, 33-to-1 return on investment. And I thought,
and we need this because money talks and people are not going to make change unless you can prove that it's actually going to be cost effective.
Right. But within our current kind of reimbursement model, none of the incentives are really aligned to make this stuff work. But it one thing that's been changing recently, and this might be something that you look into as far as folks to reach out to, the self-insured captives are the first entities that are realizing that they have maybe an 8 to 10 year window before they're effectively bankrupt. Now, this is true virtually across the board in all kind of like westernized societies. It's maybe like 15 years or something. But when you overlay population increase with healthcare increase, there is it's an exponentially increasing story. All kinds of other collateral damage with that, you know, amputations and dialysis and all this stuff. But it's basically going to bankrupt societies.
Yes,
and,
it is.
And people will say, well, socialize the medicine and do this and do that. Like, that doesn't change the curve on this at all, you know. Again, I want to ask this, but I don't want to do too leading of a question here. But what do you see as being the problematic features of the insurance system as it stands right now with regards to healthcare? Like, how is it contributing to this problem?
Right. Well, I'm a little radical. Like, I sort of am more of a socialized medicine person. I feel like we need to focus on preventative care. And frankly, I'd like to take the middlemen out of things. You know, insurance companies and billers and, you know, coders and all that stuff. I'll tell you, my mom was over in Scotland a couple of years ago and she had some chest pain. Now, my mom is healthy, has really no medical problems, doesn't take some vitamin, you know, but she's an older woman who had chest pain. So she goes to the emergency room in Scotland and she gets worked up and gets, you know, her cardiac workup or whatever. And she gets, you know, she gets discharged. She goes, where's the billing department so I can pay my bill? And they were like, what? Like, they don't even have a department. There's no billers. There's no coders. Like, all that money that hospitals spend on that middleman stuff is just gone. They don't have, it's not a cost for them. So I'm a little more extreme in the sense that I sort of feel that, like, we need to focus on lifestyle and prevention. And, you know, like, the pharmaceutical companies, like, you know, people make a lot of money when we're sick. Okay, because the food industry makes a lot of money. The pharmaceutical companies, it's just like war. Like, people say they don't want war, but there's some people who make a lot of money when we go to war. And the same is true for when people are really sick. So I'm a little more radical probably than you expected, but.
No, it's interesting. So I tend to be more in this kind of libertarian market oriented camp. And so some of my thought, and it's all crazy stuff, but I would love it if there were five American medical associations.
Okay.
Each one of them could plant a flag in the ground and say, we're the high carb, low fat vegan camp, and here's where we go. And hey, here's the ancestral health camp, and here's this camp, and here's that camp.
Right.
And then have them compete against each other.
Right.
It would be a fascinating thing. I don't think that that's really necessarily going to happen, but there is some interesting stuff. Like, if you look at the cost of LASIK eye surgery over the course of time, it's followed this thing called Moore's Law, where it's basically gotten much, much better and much less expensive over the course of time. And there's no reimbursement for it at all. It's all elective care, you know, it's out of your pocket. And Singapore has a really interesting system where it is a state mandated healthcare system, but they run the whole thing via health savings accounts.
Yep.
And if you're poor, then the state puts money into an account, but you basically then are in charge of where you put your healthcare dollars, and everything is completely transparent. Like it's like going to a Chinese food restaurant and you've got like the menu of options and what have you. And it's by no means perfect, but their spend and what they produce, like, I lean towards these kind of market centric interventions.
Right. Yeah. I see what you mean. That's super interesting. I mean, I guess the only thing that, I mean, you said the government would put money into, you know, health savings account for people who couldn't afford it. A lot of the folks that I take care of in the emergency room, the bulk of people are people who are struggling financially. And, you know, they don't have the money to spend on a gym membership or a health coach or this or that. And so I just worry about and they don't have access to healthy food, even though we live in farmland, like they might not have money to put in the gas to drive to a farm, you know, that sort of thing. And so I do tend to kind of feel, I worry about that, you know, that segment of population that just doesn't really have anything extra when it comes to HSAs. Right. That's the only problem with HSAs. And we have an HSA and I like that because we're healthy and we can pick and choose what to use it for. But I could see it being an issue if somebody has nothing, or if somebody gets something terrible that happens, and you know, it's a huge cost.
Right.
So,
And that's how they set these things up. They have this catastrophic plan, and then they use the HSA for more the discretionary stuff day to day.
But it gives people more power and more decision making around their own healthcare, which is really nice.
And you know, the challenge, and this is the thing that I always try to figure out a balance with, is we want these nets so that people don't just like auger completely into a mountainside with these
because you need the nets, because otherwise it's more expensive for society. And that's what I see. So people use the ER, like people use the ER all the time for their regular care, because they don't, like, they can't afford the office visit for their primary care doctor.
Right.
Like, you know what I mean? So they use the ER, which is more expensive, but they don't, technically I have to see everybody who comes through the door, which is what I like about my job, but you know, that means people are using it inappropriately.
But the danger that sometimes emerges with these programs is the safety net becomes a noose that they can't get out of, sometimes generationally. And this Singapore model is interesting, where these HSAs, let's say somebody, they've been unemployed, they're getting some governmental assistance, they're putting this money in their HSA account. When they get a job that pays much better, that money goes with them. So they're not losing that. For some folks, if they get destitute enough, they end up having like a low middle income based around subsidies, basically, you know, and they might need to earn $70,000 a year to match the degree of, governmental expenditures that they get. And that's sometimes a monumental hurdle to get the person out of that scene. And then some of the nervousness that I have too is the government hasn't really been making good decisions around the dietary recommendations.
I totally agree with you. Yeah. And I like the idea of thinking out of the box. Actually, I mean, I'm not by no means a, you know, expert on health policy, but before I went to medical school, I did some research for a physician down in Rhode Island who, in his small town of Scituate, Rhode Island, they were kind of piloting something called population-based primary care, where everyone in this geographical area kind of paid in, and they had access to their local doc, it was primary care. So it didn't cover catastrophic, but it's kind of a grassroots way of dealing with lapses in healthcare coverage. Just another thinking out of the box kind of thing to do. You know, you get a nice, you know, group of people, they know each other personally, and they're just invested in their community.
Right.
And in their neighbor, because the truth is people do want their neighbors to be healthy, but it's hard when it's kind of this huge corporation and, you know, it doesn't feel so personal.
Right. Well, and you know, it's interesting. So I've been tinkering off and on with a book on this topic for like seven years. And before World War II, all of the healthcare in the United States looked largely like what you just described. Like people tended to carry a catastrophic plan.
Yep.
And then it was mainly cash and carry, but also a ton of these things that look kind of like Medishares, where people would group aggregate like around their church or like different civic organizations and stuff like that. But the interesting backstory with the changes around World War II, there was a wage freeze here in the States because it was looked upon as kind of gauche that people might get paid more than these deployed GIs, getting shot and blown up and everything. So they froze wages. But what, as with all this stuff, you try to control one thing and then something else pops up. And what companies started doing was incentivizing benefits packages. Mm. So they said, hey, what if we give you free healthcare? And this was kind of the beginning of this third party payer system. The third party payer system didn't really exist prior to the end of World War II. And then over the course of time, it's just kind of grown and it has supplanted virtually all, again, other than like plastic surgery and things like LASIK, this elective medical interventions, most of medicine now nests under this third party payer system, which is this really oblique system. You know, like if you're the doctor, I'm the patient, and somebody else is paying for it, the payer really wants to screw you over. They don't want to pay you anything.
Of course. So
like they will, you know, like they have a whole algorithm where like one third of claims, they just don't pay outright and you've got to follow up on them and hopefully you don't. And me, you know, if I'm paying into this kitty, then I don't really care what the ultimate cost is.
Right.
And then as the medical provider.
That's so fascinating. I didn't know that history.
Yeah. And then as the medical provider, whether it's a hospital or a private practice doctor, if those even exist anymore, they have to constantly continue to ratchet their costs up to absorb the shenanigans on the part of the third party payer. And like if we bought tomatoes or cars this way, it would be absolute chaos, you know? Yep. So yeah, it's interesting, but this is some of the stuff that I think is really worth having conversations around. And it's so big and so complex that, you know, we definitely need to, you know, just kick this stuff around. And I think be willing to do a lot of experimentation. This is some of the stuff that was, like, I would love if, the federal government said, okay, all 50 of you states, you guys are going to do some experiments and tinker with this for 5 years. And then we're going to look at best practices. And then we're going to make best practice recommendations across the board. And this is actually what happened under Bill Clinton with his Welfare Reform Act. Instead of them assuming that they had an answer, they actually kicked it back to the states and they had 50 different reaction vessels trying to mull through this. And some of the attempts were absolute disasters. Like you couldn't even imagine that people thought that these were good ideas. And then other things were really good, like some, you know, work programs and creating some skin in the game and incentives. And I guess that, you know, like it would make me happy. And I think we would get much more traction as far as like finding legit solutions if we had multiple experiments going on instead of just this one mega experiment.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, one of the reasons that my husband and I moved to Maine was kind of for that. We felt like, you know, Boston, Massachusetts just was, you know, it's big, it's busy, there's just a lot of people. But Maine, like, it's really, you definitely have access to your local politicians, you have access to local, you know, it just, you can get involved in a way that it's harder to do on a national level or in a bigger state. And so when it comes to healthcare, I've been sort of feeling out, like, how can I get involved? Like, what do I really want? Like, who can I talk to? Because I live literally a stone's throw to the state house. Like as a physician, you know, I definitely am trying to feel out, but I don't know. I'm sort of like, I think this conversation is so interesting. Like, I don't know. Like these conversations are so important to have because I'm not sure what would be the best. Like, I don't know what I want to go fight for, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting. The work that we've done with the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, which they are a nonprofit legal entity that basically, like when the feds go and try to shut down like an Amish dairy because they're selling raw milk, like these are the people that basically intervene on their behalf.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Amazing people. And what they said, something that's really interesting, emails don't matter. Letters have a little bit of influence, but if 10 or 12 people call a representative and call them and articulate a point, and this representative hears this point, like phone calls and in-person stuff really does matter. It really does influence things. And you wouldn't think that it would, but what they've mentioned, like they've been in these you know, down to the wire situations where they're trying to get bills passed to legalize the sale and even possession of raw dairy and some stuff like that. And the phone calls of 10 or 12 people ended up swinging the thing such that the representatives, you know, bought in on them. So I think that we do really underestimate the power that we could have if we even had a few folks call or show up in person to, you know, to the public representatives.
Yeah. And I've heard that about the email thing. I remember hearing that, you know, because you can always generate like all these emails, like, you know, from bots or whatever.
Right.
I don't know. I don't, obviously my technical stuff is a little lacking, but you know, I know that's, it's harder. So yeah, showing up in person. Yeah. It's, it's a big problem.
It is. And you know, we're doing some work with the Chickasaw Nation and, just a dramatically insulin resistant population facing some really dire, healthcare you know, costs in the foreseeable future. And, you know, after getting back from hanging out with them for a full week out in Oklahoma, what was fascinating is talking to the doctors, talking to the health coaches that they have. There was a profound sense of the need to provide skin in the game for the participants in their programs.
The
lack of incentives for people to be bought into this, they feel, is actually at root cause to the current problem they have.
So what sort of incentives are they talking about?
Both financial and social. With okay. my NDA, that's as deep as I could go
yeah.
into it.
Yeah,
but
yeah, it's
fascinating though, because it starts looking very marketized. And there's still the charter of these folks is to provide the utmost service to the people of the Chickasaw Nation. But what's fascinating is they are fully in recognition that their current model, which is incredibly generous, but requires no real buy-in with regards to dietary choices and exercise and everything, that's right. not going to fix anything. And they've rolled out various initiatives and they've been, they've mainly been getting the people who already ate well and went to the gym.
I know. Well, I think, you know, having the what we've found around here is that having conversations like in your community is probably makes the biggest difference. Like I work in an ER, everyone's unhealthy. I work shift work. So does everybody else. You know, there's always like junk food around in the ER because people are stressed. They stress eat. I mean, it's like the worst, right? And I just started, I started doing time restricted feeding a couple of years ago. And that's kind of where I started the conversation. And I just started being honest about, people would ask, what do you do for health? And I always thought people would think I'm crazy if I'm like, yeah, I don't eat breakfast. Like, but I just started having conversations, and now, you know, going to the ER and everyone's like, hey, are you ready to break your fast yet? Or yeah, I'm just going to get some eggs like downstairs. And it's normalized it in an environment where that was totally abnormal a year ago. And I really, that's been probably just having these conversations and educating people about, I mean, I think educating people about actually their physiology and hormones and getting a little more sciencey is really helpful if people have that kind, if they're able to understand that, which a lot of people are.
Yeah, I don't know if you know Mark Cucuzella, but he's a VA system doc, rural West Virginia, low carber, marathoner. Like the guy has run Boston Marathon like 30 years in a row or something like that.
So cool.
Yeah, he's an amazing guy, but he deals with a very rural population, and he'll have folks show up in the emergency room with a blood sugar of 500 and they're doing like 200 units of insulin a day or something. Mm-hmm. And he shows them a sheet of green foods, yellow foods, and red foods. And he'll go through and say, okay, what on this green list will you eat for breakfast? Boom, boom, boom. Okay, there's breakfast. What will you eat for lunch? Boom, boom, boom. Okay, nothing. One or two things on the yellow list, nothing from the red list. And he's getting some really remarkable results with that. He makes himself super accessible. And he, you know, circling this back to earlier in the conversation and kind of the risk exposure, what he's recommending are whole unprocessed foods. He really monitors their meds closely. And then at the end of the day, if somebody were to ask him, well, how can you justify what you're doing? Their meds go down and their lab values improve.
Exactly. I have a very good friend who does some admin, but also practices medicine in the VA system in Maine. She's a primary care doc. And what she tells her vets is if a caveman couldn't have eaten it, then you shouldn't. If you have to open a package, you shouldn't be eating it.
Right.
And she gets a lot of, you know, that's been huge. The other thing is she'll have people, if they have an iPhone, you know, get MyFitnessPal, and she just says just 100 carbohydrates a day. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can log stuff and just start to notice where stuff is. And she's got, you know, vets coming in going, hey doc, like I'm off my insulin, or I lost 50 pounds. I mean, it's really, it's so powerful. And it's like, she's actually asking them to do less, take something away, not add something,
right?
You know,
right.
And they're getting better health. And I'm so excited about this. I sometimes we'll talk to people about this on my overnight shifts when it's like a little slow, you know, somebody's saying they have back pain and I'm like, honestly, like you need to lose 50 pounds. And this one woman who I talked to about this, she had chronic abdominal pain. This was months and months ago. And I had suggested, hey, like you should, you know, read this book called The Obesity Code or like talking to her a little bit about insulin and stuff. And she came back for some sort of musculoskeletal thing a couple months later and told the PA who saw her, oh yeah, I've lost 40 pounds. My husband's lost 60 just from my small conversation that was probably like 20 minutes long. Wow. Yeah. Now that was a motivated person who, you know, was obviously interested in learning about it, but like, it's pretty crazy. It's not that complicated.
No, it's not. It's really not. No, it's incredible. Oh, I just have to share this story with you. Because I have some questions. But we were talking to some folks who have a beautiful hospital system, and they were kind of recognizing, you know, the food that we have, like in the vending machines and in the cafeteria, 90% of it's junk. We're going to totally revamp this thing. And so they went to like the snacks were basically like fruit and jerky. More or less. Like that. Yeah, which was amazing.
This was a public school?
No, this was a hospital.
Privately
owned hospital. Okay, so here's the situation. All of the junk food, the sodas, all that stuff have been removed. The employees don't have access to it. The patrons, the people that would go in and out. What do you think happens after that?
To the health of the...
Just in general, what happens? I knew immediately, like they told me that they did this and I knew exactly what happened.
I don't know.
I said, one of your staff members started bringing sodas and Snickers and selling them. And they did. There was a nurse in the ICU. They named her Nurse Snickers. And she would go to Costco and buy a flat of Snickers. And then she would dispense these things from her desk to the staff. They didn't give it to very many patients. Some of the patients caught wind and she would give it to them instead of selling it to them. And then there was another individual that would basically smuggle in like a flat of soda. And then they would go track this guy down. And so this is a little bit of my circle back again, where if people don't understand economics and markets, they are doomed to find solutions, because it was very well intentioned, but they didn't have any leverage over the next step to this thing, which whenever you create a police state, a prohibition type situation, then you create a black market almost inevitably. Like you've got to be really crafty about how you align incentives around all that stuff.
Right. And I think you need buy-in from everyone involved. So I do some administrative time at the hospital and I had a meeting with this wellness committee because I'm trying to bring them in and do health coaching like during the shifts for the nurses that work 12 hours, which is crazy. And, you know, we were talking about, okay, when it's a bad day at the hospital, what does admin do? They go out and buy pizzas. But everybody I talk to is trying to lose weight and be healthy. So why are we putting this right in front of people who potentially could have food addiction or have their own issues, you know, with this food? And she said that in their department, in the wellness department, what happened is they really sat down as a group. And it was kind of like group therapy. Like they all sort of talked about their struggles and said, you know what, instead of admin telling them to do something, they as a department made the decision that they want to be a health conscious department. So it came from the employees, not from admin. And that was really powerful for me because I think it really has to come from the employees. It can't come from like me waving my finger and saying, we're going to stop buying you pizza. You know what I mean? Like more like, let's have a conversation as a department. What kind of department do we want to be? Like, do we want to foster resilience and mindfulness and health? Or do we want to be all stressed out because our job is really stressful and it's made worse by some of these choices? So that was really interesting to me when she said that. I hadn't thought of that because I was sort of like, well, as the administrator, I'm going to come in and like make everybody. Well, that doesn't work, you know, because you don't have buy-in.
Right. No, it's fascinating. It's fascinating. And, you know, it's a thorny topic talking to people about aligning incentives, and you sound like this heartless, you know, person, but
Well, especially when you talk about food, because there is so much emotion and guilt and shame. And, you know, I really do believe that some people really struggle with food addiction. And I think until we acknowledge that, it's going to be hard to change things, at least for those folks. And my husband and I say this all the time. Okay, if you have a family member who struggles with alcoholism, like, you're not going to see him at Thanksgiving and say, oh, like, have a beer. You've done so well over the past 8 years. You can have one. Like, everybody knows that's sort of ridiculous. And yet we do that to our friends and family members when it comes to food and sugar and, oh, you've done so well. Just eat that cookie.
We did a survey of our followers, and one of the primary, you know, challenge points that people have is what we broadly put under the bucket of social. And it was that friends, family members, coworkers, you know, fellow students, whatever their situation was, it's so interesting. We noticed this ages ago, but if you show up at work or school or what have you, and you've got a bag of Doritos and a big soda and all this stuff, nobody says a damn thing. But if you show up with like chicken breast and avocado, and you've got an iced tea with a little MCT oil in it, people will lose their minds. They'll tell you you're going to die on the spot, and they will do their level best to derail you. It's like, hey, man, here's the bowl of peanut M&Ms, you know?
And part of that is their own stuff, right? Yes, it's like people bring their own stuff, and they always, misery wants company. You know, I don't – people worry that, like, if you're eating healthy – because I've struggled that. I mean, my parents raised me to be mindful of what we're eating. And like, I remember comments from friends, and it's like, people think that I'm judging them for eating junk. And I'm like, look, dude, I'm just doing my own thing. Like, but they get insecure about it. Like, you know, people who make unhealthy choices get insecure when they're around people who eat healthily. And so, you know, if you can get someone to indulge with you, you feel better.
Right.
And it's just, there's so much like stuff that people deal with around food. It's so unfortunate because it can be such a pleasure and so, you know, such a wonderful thing, eating good food.
But. Yeah. Yeah. And to your, you know, kind of addiction analogy, you really don't have to take cocaine or alcohol or what have you. You know, you can really avoid that, but at some point you will eat again. Like, even if you do,
right? And it's around you all the time.
It's around you, and
every single. Yeah. I actually went to the grocery store once. I was with my kids, and when we're in the checkout line, there's a bunch of candy, and I say to my kids, "That's not real food. We just don't eat that. That's not real food, and it's not. It's a bunch of chemicals." And you know, I went to the manager, and I said, look, like, have you guys ever thought about getting rid of all this stuff in the aisles? Because it's really not fair, you know, to kids. This is all, you know, he said, well, these big food companies pay for their slots.
Right.
You know, at the grocery store, which I didn't realize, but I should have known. But yeah, I was just like, oh, okay.
Yeah. And this again, you know, we're getting back into the, you know, the incentives, the government should not be in the business of subsidizing sugar and processed seed oils. You know, like, a Twinkie should not be cheaper than an apple. Like, that's you know, again, creating all these super misaligned incentives. Even in Mexico, they enacted a pretty frisky tax on sodas, which again, I would tackle it first from, let's stop subsidizing this stuff. But it, like, the U.S. government still both subsidizes and taxes tobacco, which is like a foot on the brake and the gas pedal at the same time. Absolutely.
Right.
It befuddles me, but whatever. But they did get a pretty significant change in consumption behavior, like punitive tax on the sodas. And there's a sweet spot there. It's interesting. If you make them too expensive out on the open market, then you create a black market that will provide the stuff cheaper.
You know, and people get all, you know, I don't want somebody telling me what to eat.
Right.
But I have to say that, like, you know, we all pay for it in the end.
Right.
You know, and I say that the same thing. So we don't have a helmet law in Maine for motorcycles. Mm-hmm. And I had this guy once who was transferred to Boston Medical Center, who was in a really bad motorcycle accident. He was in New Hampshire, so he wasn't wearing a helmet. I said, "You're crazy, man. You weren't wearing your helmet. Like, what were you thinking?" You know, and he was like, "Well, like, I just figured that, like, if I got in an accident, like, I'd rather just, like, die." And I'm like, "But you won't die, because that's how good medicine is. We'll keep you alive. You'll be in a nursing home. You'll have a, you know, peg to help you, you know, eat, and you'll have, you know, all this stuff." And I'm like, I know it's your right to not wear a helmet, but like, are you going to pay for that? Like,
that's my thing. You know, stuff like that. And this is some interesting stuff where you know, to the degree that it, so generally insurance like that would be more, you know, catastrophic. But if the if dude wants one, I think, you know, I love riding motorcycles, but I haven't done it for ages. And now that I have kids, I probably never will, other than maybe a dirt bike. But if you want to ride a motorcycle, you should probably pay a pretty frisky premium just as a baseline, because the likelihood of you costing a lot is fairly high. Right. And then if you're in one of those states, Nevada is a state that doesn't have a helmet law, and you choose not to ride with a helmet, your premium each month should be like $5,000 for that.
Right.
Like
People sometimes don't have insurance. I mean, a lot of people don't have insurance that ride motorcycles. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, that's where you definitely have to start kind of aligning incentives at some point. You know, we can't just collectively deal with that stuff and just keep kind of papering over the problem, you know. But it's fascinating.
So fascinating.
You know, what are some of the, so clearly you are trying to reach out to your local community, local governance, making inroads there. What do you see that looking like over maybe the next 3 to 5 years? Like, what are the bright points that you've seen with that?
Right. That's such a good question, because it's definitely something that I've been soul searching about as of late. I mean, I think where I'm going is, my husband and I have a podcast for local Mainers, Simply Health ME, and we do classes, and I do just, you know, I'm talking at the library about kids' nutrition, health. I think that as I get this obesity medicine training, I'd like to branch out and maybe teach physicians in the area. Mm-hmm. And then of course, try to figure out how I can make a change with the school board, you know, just like kind of local level stuff. But I have to be honest, you know, I have a 5-year-old, I have a 3-year-old, I work full time as a physician. Like, it's a delicate balance, as I'm sure you're quite aware of, is like, okay, I feel really passionate about this, but I also have to keep my sanity and keep my own health. Right. And so I am in the middle of doing a lot of soul searching about that very question.
That's awesome. Well, I mean, this is year 20 for me in this process. So, honestly,
and it's probably ever changing.
It is ever changing. And honestly, we've made more progress in many ways than I ever thought that we would. Like, I never thought I would live to see a venture capital backed ketogenic diet intervention like Virta. Like,
that is amazing to me.
It's amazing. But then at the same time, I'm seeing ever more of a tendency for folks to kind of slide towards wanting to consolidate power within the government and make recommendations from that point. And this is where, you know, like the big food, if this stuff was all broken up, if we had 50 food and drug administrations at the state level, that's a lot more people that you need to buy off and coerce and everything versus one, or like a singular entity. And the dominant story that's coming more and more from this government level dietary recommendations is very strong in that kind of plant-based vegan approach, which can have benefits to some people. But
But again, dogma is always bad. Like, if you are stuck in one, you have to recognize it depends on the person. Like, that's one thing. Like, I like low carb, high fat. I like a keto approach. But you know what? I don't judge people who decide they want to go vegan or vegetarian. It might work for them. And the problem is, like, getting so divisive over this stuff.
Right.
And really, it all comes down to not eating processed food. I mean, that's what it all comes down to. There's actually an underlying commonality between all this stuff.
Right. That was that recent Diet Fits intervention where they had a healthy low-carb group, a healthy high-carb group. Both groups lost virtually the same amount of weight, but what was interesting is that both groups started off at what we would perceive as being these extremes, and they had a tendency over time to kind of drift to this middle ground. And it's that middle ground, interestingly, which is right square with the recommendations from like the American Dietetics Association and what have you. There was that LEARN program that was compared in the A to Z diet study, Atkins, Ornish, et cetera. And this LEARN thing is like, it's going to sound terrible, but like every dietitian's wet dream. It's like, do not have any commentary about food quality. Like, literally, there was no commentary about food quality just portion control. So like just only have a third of a Twinkie and all that stuff. And not surprisingly, out of that dietary intervention, the LEARN protocol performed the worst. It performed quite a bit worse even than the Ornish intervention, which I'm not really a fan of. But
yeah,
to your point, like we kind of have to pick something. It's either high carb, low fat, or higher fat, lower carb. And we really have to stay out of the middle, which is the snack aisle and the buffet and all the rest of that stuff. Yeah,
exactly. And you have to, you know, also finding things that work for you outside of obviously processed food. But like my friend who works at the VA, her dietitian is really anti-ketogenic and is really into the veganism. But she goes, look, I'm not going to get my vets to be vegan. Okay, that's just not going to happen. So let's move on.
Right.
Like that doesn't even make sense.
Right. Well, so, we definitely, we have a ton of job security. Our work is not going to go away anytime soon.
I say that almost every day.
Well, Doc, it's been so great chatting with you. I'm really honored you reached out to me. Can you let folks know where they can track you down on the interwebs to learn more about you?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we have a website. I do some blog posts, my creative outlet, simplyhealthme.com. And then we have a podcast, Simply Health ME for Maine, of course. And then a Facebook page under the same name. So we do talk a lot about Maine, but like it's sort of general health stuff. So.
That's amazing. Well, you know, and I think that really is where all this stuff starts, is the individual passion and building those relationships. Like when I've spoken publicly and people say, why haven't you gone to Congress or whatever? And it's like, are you kidding me? You know, if I'm able to get some traction, it's going to be at the local level. And
exactly.
That's it. And then over the course of time, we may get some push, you know, further up the food chain. But at the end of the day, we really just kind of have to take some personal accountability and get in and fight these fights. And again, it's interesting. These self-insured captives are really looking around closely at different wellness programs and wellness initiatives because they're on the hook for dealing with these costs.
Yeah.
And all of them have a very short run before they're effectively insolvent due to these healthcare costs. So I think people are going to start asking some very pointed questions and start figuring out how to align the incentives to get better buy-in in this.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Well, Doc, it's been such an honor having you on the show and hopefully get to meet you in real life.
Yeah, it'd be great. So enjoy the rest of the day.
Thanks, you too. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks again for listening to the Paleo Solution Podcast. Here's a quick message from one of our sponsors.
You know, the true definition of sleep, circuitous, it's the lack of wakefulness, right? And you have to allow the wakefulness promoting hormones and neurotransmitters to go away. And it's in our language. You drift off to sleep. You fall to sleep. You slide into sleep, right? You don't push a button and go, I'm on to sleep now. Like, it doesn't work that way.
That's Dr. Kirk Parsley, sleep expert and former Navy SEAL. And Doc Parsley wasn't just a SEAL. He was also the physician for the SEALs. He created the sleep cocktail product after years of working with SEALs suffering from chronic sleep issues. How does the sleep cocktail work? Let's let Doc Parsley tell us.
All my supplement does is it truly supplements, or it just supplements all of the substrates along the melatonin pathway. Gives you a really, really low dose of melatonin just to kickstart it off. So you're getting just a dusting of melatonin that's just enough to kind of help you initiate the cascade. And then I talked a little bit about GABA increasing as you go to sleep and kind of slowing down the neocortex. So there's a form of GABA in there, a GABA derivative called PH-GABA that really is just a way to get GABA to cross the blood-brain barrier so that it can actually work in the brain and the body. And that's it. I mean, that's it.
Give Doc Parsley's sleep cocktail a try. Go to robwolf.com/sleepcocktail and use code ROBWOLF10 to save 10%.